So what I was going to do as usual is to repeat more or less what I did last time, only real quickly, and then go on. The office hours are now up on the webpage. This class ends at 4. I have another class that starts at 6. I put up the office hours as 4:30 to 5:30, but if you grab me after this class and you want to talk at 4:05, that's fine. And if you grab me at 5:30 and I'm not desperately hungry, I'm happy to go until 5:50 or something. But basically, roughly 4:30 to 5:30. What we were discussing, are there any... there's one marker here. I have got to do something about the limited supply of markers. Anyway, we're discussing decision theory. Decision theory is basically a set of fairly simple tools that you use to organize the information that you use to make decisions. It's not the be-all and end-all of anything, but it's sort of useful if you've got complicated things to have a way of...
I just want to let you know, I think some of us have class, they have a weird schedule. I have a class at 2:38, and starts at 2:40, so...
Right. Thank you. Yes. That's bizarre. Why do you have class to 2:38? Do you know?
I have one on Monday.
Weird. All right. Thank you for telling me that. That is useful information. All right. Let's see if I can answer the question I was asking before, was whether it would be possible. Yes. Aha. We forget about that, and now I can make marks on that. Isn't that wonderful? I have just invented a new teaching device. Like many of my inventions, it's probably been invented before. But Ronald Coase, for example, had the discourtesy to publish one of my ideas about 20 years before I did. Not his famous idea, but one of his. One thing that I had an article on that it turned out the core idea was in an old article of his. There we are. Let me stretch this a little. I should say, if any of you are Macintosh people, that I've had this problem for quite a while, that my standard drawing program was AppleWorks, which was one of these combined word processor, drawer, etc. programs. And Apple abandoned it like 10 years ago. And so it's become gradually clunkier and clunkier as the operating system changed. And I just discovered this morning that NeoOffice, which I know you people know about OpenOffice, which is the free open source version of Microsoft Office, essentially. And it turns out that while Microsoft Office does not, as far as I know, contain a drawing module, that NeoOffice does. And so I've just been having fun with that this morning. And this is, I think, something that I had done in AppleWorks and then cut and pasted into the NeoOffice thing. Anyway, we'll get to that in a few minutes, but I'm delighted to find out that I can forget about the screen. All I have to do is to figure out how to adjust how high everything is so that it won't get that break in the middle. All right, so the basic logic of basic mechanics is that a square represents a choice you are making. That choice then has some cost associated with it. In this case, if you reject the settlement offer, you've got to go to court, and that's going to cost you $30,000. You will then sometimes end up with a random event, a probabilistic event. That's what a circle represents. And in this case, the circle has a 90% chance, 0.9 probability, that you will win your case and owe nothing, and a 10% chance on the... This is a problem in the handout... 10% chance that you will owe $100,000 in damages plus suffer reputational losses that your client regards as another $200,000. All right? That's a useful point, by the way, that there's sort of a tendency, because we're putting everything in dollars, to assume that all that matters is money. Of course, money doesn't really matter. Money is an intermediate for things that matter, like eating and, you know, having nice houses and all sorts of other things. In this particular case, the non-monetary term is larger than the monetary. And there, in fact, is an economist who I know who did an article quite a long time ago looking at firms that had been charged with essentially cheating their customers. And he did what people in business schools refer to as an event study. An event study means trying to tease out the effect on a firm of a single event. So you say, all right, what was the stock price of the firm before it became public they were being charged with this? What was it afterwards? Well, but other things were changing. So you then try to say, well, what was happening to other firms in the industry that weren't being charged? Maybe the industry was going up or down. And you then use multiple regression style statistics that we'll talk about at the end of the semester to try to say, all right, what's my best estimate of how much less the company was worth after this announcement was made? And his conclusion was that the loss in value to the company was many times larger than the largest fine they could be charged for what they were being accused of doing. So that suggested, and that was really quite intriguing, that perhaps the real function of the legal system in a case like that isn't to punish companies. It's to generate the information which results in their customers punishing them. Not punishing them because they want to hurt them, but punishing them because they decide we can't trust these people, we should buy from somebody else. That was sort of an interesting piece of economic research by an ex-student of mine, which is one reason I paid attention to it. Anyway, so what are we doing? I don't really need the picture quite yet. We'll get back to it in a little bit. We've got payoffs. Basically, the information we have is choices, payoffs. Yeah, this is not a very good marker. And probabilities. Missing anything? Costs, I guess. If the marker was working better, I'd add costs, but it isn't. It's dying. And I don't see any more. So, aha! Very good. Thank you. Is there another one over there too? Is that a blue one? Yeah. Great. Thank you. I'm not sure if that's really a marker, but it'll do. All right. Great. Thank you. I need to steal a few of these. So probabilities and costs. And these are all numbers, except for the choices. And you don't really know any of them, but you have estimates of them. Generally, the way the decision theory is set up in the book and elsewhere is you start already knowing what your choices are. And one of the things that's worth doing when you finish doing one of these problems is say, wait a minute, are there some alternatives I didn't consider? Maybe I should have not done either A or B, but some different C. But that's, if you did that, you'd then redraw your diagram accordingly. All right. So what you then do is you end up with one of these complicated diagrams or simple diagrams, which goes boom, 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 etc. This is a very simple one where you've got one choice. This choice has no probabilistic elements at all. This is, for example, agreeing to settle out of court. Another choice which has a probabilistic element, which is the chance of winning. And then there will be various costs and probabilities here. Costs all over the place. Outcomes. You look at the last bit and you say, all right, if we got to here, what's the value of being here? Well, it's the probability of this outcome times its payoff plus the probability of this outcome times this payoff. That's the expected value. Put that number in here. Now, forget about the rest of it. Just look as though it goes to this and this, which is higher, go to the one that's higher. So it's not a very profound mechanism, but it's sort of a nice way of tidying up your thoughts about things, if that makes sense. All right. So you start at the right end. You're the last step of the process and just work your way back. And someone was asking about something I had mentioned earlier, and that's then I think mentioned in the book, which is subgain perfect equilibrium. And that's really what happens if you take this mechanism for two people instead of one. So that instead of saying, I know what he's going to do, what should I do? For example, instead of saying, I know that he will accept an out-of-court settlement of this amount, and the only alternative is to go to court, you might say, well, if I offer him this amount, what will he do? If I offer him that amount, what will he do? And you would then have a second box. And this box is the other player, all right, the other party in the litigation. And you would then look at his possible choices. And you would say, well, his choices may lead to probabilistic events. They may not, but in the simplest case, they then lead to a choice by me, either way, and so forth. Yeah, you get this sort of spider web going across. And you then, in sub-game proof of equilibrium, you look at the last step in that process and you say, who makes the last choice? What choice will he make? Well, since this is the last choice, we can evaluate the outcomes and he will make the choice that gives him the best return for himself. Fine, we can forget about everything but the right of that. We now know what he does here. Just work right to left until we've solved the problem. That's the nature of sub-game proof of equilibrium. Nice and simple and tidy, and the one, I would argue, fundamental problem with it is the assumption that it's a single game in a vacuum, and that therefore, when I get to the last stage, I will do the thing that's in my interest, as opposed to my saying, at the beginning of this game, I'm going to explain to you very clearly that if you do push me to here, I'm going to go there. It's going to hurt me, but it's going to hurt you a lot more. And because you know I'm going to do that, you're not going to push me to here, and that'll get me down here, which is better for me. Does that make sense as a sort of pattern of human behavior that we're all familiar with? I think I've got, I don't remember if this course or a different course where I work out the putting the small child to bed game in those terms. Small children are quite good at strategic behavior, and it is true that making a scene is not going to do any good for the child, but knowing that the child would make a scene might result in you're not taking the actions the child doesn't want you to take. All right, and a lot of us behave that way, grown-ups and children together. All right, anyway, so let me run through a few more things and then I'm going to stop and see whether you have questions from what you've read or from what we did last time, and then we can work through the problems in the handout and the problems in the book. So first point to make is that the expected return of the gamble, that is sum of probabilities times payoffs, is only the right answer if you're risk neutral. In fact, that's the definition in economics of being risk neutral. If somebody is risk neutral is somebody who, given two alternative lotteries, think of a lottery as a combination of probabilities and payoffs. Given two alternative lotteries, someone who's risk neutral will always pick the one with the higher expected value. Does everybody know what expected value means? I'm sort of throwing this term around. You can think of it, if you're thinking about a gamble of, if you did this a million times, what would you end up with on average? All right, that's sort of a simple way of thinking about it. So if you imagine you're a professional gambler and you've got large enough assets of time and money so that you're going to play poker, you know, 1,000 games or whatever else it is, 1,000 games, you can say, if I follow the strategy of always choosing the higher expected value, then on average I'll be richer than if I don't by the end of that process. And is it clear why that's not an adequate description of behavior of everybody? Why, for example, if somebody said to one of you, we've got this great gamble for you, I'm going to assume for a moment that the value of everything you own is $100,000. And somebody said, we've got this gamble for you. We're going to flip a coin. Heads, we give you $100,000. Tails, you lose $95,000. Anybody in this room who would take that gamble, assuming that your assets are maybe some of you are really rich, but assuming your assets are really $100,000, would anybody take that gamble? No. Why wouldn't you take that gamble? Because dollars aren't what matter. What matters is what you get with the dollars. Yeah, you were going to say. But that's just saying the same thing over again. That's a somewhat misleading term, as I'll get to in a minute, though. It's a standard term for it. But, yeah?
Well, I would say that the potential loss compared to the value you have now is very high.
And it's higher than the potential gain if we don't think of it in dollars. Because dollars, as I said before, aren't what really matters. The potential loss is going from your present state of life to living in a homeless shelter or something like that. That's a really big hit. The potential gain is that you get to have a nicer car and a somewhat bigger apartment and you go to restaurants more often, a list of desirable features that are a whole lot less desirable than living the way you do now instead of in a homeless shelter. All right. So the basic point, the way economists normally put it, is they talk about the declining marginal utility of income. Marginal utility of income is how much better off you are having one more dollar in terms of your values. And we would expect that if your income is currently $10,000, the value to you of another dollar is probably a lot more than if your income is $100,000. A dollar is a dollar, but the 10,000 means hamburger instead of beans. The extra dollar when you're at 10,000 is hamburger instead of beans, and when you're at 100,000, it means a marginally nicer suit or something like that. All right. The reason risk aversion is a misleading term is that what we call risk aversion is really risk aversion in money. You could easily know. Problem you're going to run in all your life, because everybody does, and that is that terms sound as though they explain themselves and don't. Right? The world is full of people who think they understand the theory of relativity, except for the mathematical details. I mean, the theory of relativity says everything is relative. I understand that, right? It's not what the theory of relativity says. Ditto for lots of other things. And in this case, risk aversion sounds as though it means you're scared of risk. But you could easily enough imagine somebody who was risk averse in the economist sense and still went skydiving. He liked thrills. What he doesn't like is being in a homeless shelter versus what he's now in. So imagine, my standard example is, let's suppose that you're 30 years old and happily married, and you have a medical problem. And you go to see the doctor, and the doctor says, I have some bad news for you. You've got a choice. If we don't treat this problem, you've got about 15 years. If we do treat it and the treatment works, you will live for another 25 years. But unfortunately, if the treatment doesn't work, you're never going to come out of the anesthetic. You're going to die when we do the treatment. Well, in terms of expected value of years of life, it's a bad deal. 15 is better than half of 25. But suppose the thing you most want to do in the world is to produce and bring up children. You can't do that in 15 years. You can do it in 25 years. So in that case, you would say that you would choose the operation, which gives you a 50% chance of doing what you want instead of a 0% chance of doing what you want, even though on average you'll have fewer years of life as a result. Make sense? So that's why I object to the term risk averse, because that same person might be somebody who in monetary transactions is risk averse. This doesn't have a lot to do with the course, but it has a lot to do with understanding terminology that's often misused, so I'm doing it anyway. Alright. So that was the first point. Second point is that in doing all of this, you have to figure out the structure of choices, and that's going to be you plus the client deciding what might we choose to do, what are the uncertainties, and what are the payoffs, and some of those numbers, like the cost of litigation, you're probably going to provide, and some of them, like the reputational cost of losing a certain lawsuit, he's going to have to provide. And then finally, one of the things you will sometimes want to do is sensitivity analysis, which is basically saying, how sure am I that my result is right? That is this the case where if we change one of the numbers a little bit, I should make the opposite choice? If so, maybe I should look more carefully at some of the information that went in. All right, let me now stop, at least very briefly, and ask what questions you have, either on what we did Monday, or on what you've now read in the book, or on anything else that you might be asking questions about. Yep?
As far as the decisional analysis, what kind of, I mean, practically, you never know what the percentage of trials is. You don't know. There's just so many factors that, though extremely useful, it seems hard to apply to more than just a very basic sense. And that all we're really looking at is very basically this is it.
This is a way of thinking about the problem. It doesn't solve your ignorance. But it might tell you that some parts of ignorance don't matter. It might turn out when you look at it that I don't really have to know that number because I'm never going to go down that branch once I look at these alternatives. And so it might help you figure out what you want to know better. But all it is really is a sort of a way of thinking, a relatively simple way of thinking clearly about questions. And that's, you know, and it's also going to point you about what questions you want to ask, but it's not going to tell you how to answer them. Yeah, a lot of stuff you learn is like that. I mean, this is, again, when I give my law and econ class, that one of the points I make is I can tell you how to figure out what the law should be. The only problem is to do that, I would need a whole lot of information nobody has. All right? Nonetheless, when you figured out how, if you did have the information, you would answer the question. You know more than you did before because you now know what information is relevant. You now know, say, if this thing changes in this way, that makes this law more attractive, this law less attractive, things of that sort. So it's a useful exercise, but unfortunately or unfortunately, we're not in a world where we really get to have logically compelling answers to all our questions. Wish you, well, that might be boring if we did. Anyway, that's not the world we're in.
All right. Other comments, questions on this? All nice, clear as pea soup, however you put it. All right. Let's then run through the first of the handout questions.
Your client, Get Rich Investors, is in the retail securities brokerage. They've been sued by Quincy Quickbuck, who we know must be a villain from that name, who alleges that he was misled. Quickbuck is making a take it or leave it settlement offer of $25,000. Right, so let's go over here.
$25,000 settlement.
And what are the other relevant numbers? You decide that litigation costs
are going to be $30,000 each.
And that this frivolous and wholly unjustified lawsuit has a 10.1% chance of winning. And if that happens, you are going to lose $100,000 in cash, damage payment, plus $200,000 in reputation. All right. If you win, you're home free. So if you're setting this up as a decision problem, what's the one decision you have to make? It's a nice simple problem. What's your one decision? Anybody? Before I put it up on the screen, why don't people tell me how to draw the picture and see how they look the same? What's the decision you're making? Settle or don't settle, right? So,
settle, dump.
All right. If you settle, what's the cost of settling? No, you settle, you've got to pay him some money.
Right? No litigation cost, but there's a cost, all right.
If you don't settle, what's the initial cost, the cost you know you're going to pay?
$30,000 litigation. You then end up in a probabilistic branch. One is 0.1, one is 0.9.
All right. This sort of thing is hard for me to know if I'm wasting your time. It's all perfectly obvious. It's just everybody's too shy to say when they don't understand. It's a running problem that if you're ever a professor, you or probably even a high school teacher, you'll discover. All right, so let's look at what we have here. And what do we have? We have that if we accept, we pay $25,000. If we reject, we pay $30,000. And what should be written here? What is the expected cost to us if we go to trial? Anybody?
Right. Assuming no risk neutral.
So adding all that up, what is it going to cost if we follow this branch? 60. What is the cost if we follow that branch? What do we do? We settle. Looking at the question as stated, however, you might want to think about what the logic would look like from the other side. Suppose you're Mr. Quickbuck's lawyer. And what is the result to Mr. Quickbuck's lawyer of going to court?
What did Mr. Quickbuck ultimately?
We were told that the $30,000 was his litigation cost, too. So on average, if he goes to court, how much does he get? On average, what does he get? If he's very lucky, he gets $100,000. On average, what does he get? What? He's got a 10% chance of winning. Right? 90% chance. This is a frivolous lawsuit. You didn't cheat the poor guy. He's just trying to extort you. So, on average, from QuickBooks' side, how much does he get by going to court? He doesn't get that reputational gain. QuickBooks.
I'm assuming the QuickBooks lawyer is honest to the extent of serving his client as best he can.
So, if QuickBooks goes to court, how much money is he going to get on average in damage payments? Really? How much will the damages be if he wins? $100,000, right? The other $200,000 was reputational cost to your client. That's not going to put any money in anybody else's pocket. So what is a 10% chance to $100,000 worth?
If he goes 100,
10% of that, he gets
$50,000.
10% of 100 is
50?
That's
better. And then $30,000.
No, the $30,000 is the cost, not a benefit. Remember, $30,000 was his litigation expenses. That's right. If QuickBooks goes to court, on average, he's going to be $20,000 worse off than if he stayed home, than if he never did anything. This is a fact you might want to push a point out to Mr. QuickBooks, along with trying to persuade him that you're not going to accept the settlement offer. And then he'll agree to a reasonable settlement offer of $5,000 instead. All right. That's not in the problem that's given. I'm just pointing out sort of the next step, which is to apply the same tools to think about the other side of the transaction and realizing that while it is true that you lose by going to court in the situation as described, got something in the wrong place somehow, in the situation as described, he loses by going to court too. Did I manage to erase something that I didn't intend to erase? Let's hope not. All right, well, I had something here a moment ago. There we are. Just got away from it somehow. So if we look at this case, there we are. All right. So if we look at this case, we can see that from your standpoint, you would cut it off here and accept. But from his standpoint, if you offered him nothing at all, he would cut it off there and go home. And that information is useful information for you to use in your bargaining. All right. You happy with that? Not happy with it? Yes. No. All right, let's try the next one. And the next one involves somebody who is obviously supposed to be Michael Jordan with his name reversed. And even I, who knows nothing at all about basketball, can figure that out. And there are three possibilities. One possibility is that he's going to be fine next year and be able to play for one more year. That's a 50% chance. Right, let's erase this. So, fine. He's going to be fine 25% of the time. Poor, meaning it's going to hurt to play, I think 0.25, if I remember correctly. And he is going to be disabled the other 0.25. And the question is which contract you ought to offer. So what are the alternatives? Your choice is either offer him a contract which doesn't depend on whether he pays. You just will pay you $6 million whatever you do. And if he's fine, he'll play because he likes playing. Or alternatively say, we'll pay you $10 million contingent on your price. So how would we decide which of those to go? What's the set of steps before I graph it out? I've got it on the computer already. What's the set of steps? Your first decision is which contract to offer. What happens next? either way? What's the next step in the graph if we're drawing it up? All right, first you got a box for contract, 6 versus 10. What's the next stage on that going to be? That's not right because they care whether he plays or not. Right. Remember that they're not just paying him for the fun of it, right? They're paying him because they're going to make lots of money, $20 million, if I remember the question correctly. Is it $20 million? I think it is. If he plays, right? So therefore, they care not only on how much they pay him, but also on what he does. So what's the first, what's the next step in this? First step is we offer him a contract. What's next step? When you say three branches, what? So the next step is a random event. We flip a three-sided coin, or roll a die, or if you want to think of it, and that tells us he's either fine, can play, or it's safe. All right. How about down here? Maybe. Then we might as well look at everything. Some of them may not matter. Right? Same thing here. Right? Well, that's great. Maybe not some of those aren't very interesting, but that those are all the alternatives. So now we would like to look, go down each of these paths and say what happens. So, for example, if we offer him $6 million unconditionally and he's fine, what happens? This is a 0.5 probability, and what happens if that probability occurs? Well, you get paid 6 million anyway, right? In this one, the 6, I shouldn't put 10 here really, because 10 is not a cost. This one, from our standpoint, it's minus $6 million we have to pay him, whatever happens. So the only difference here is whether he plays or not, which determines whether we get 20 million or nothing, right? So if we agree to pay him unconditionally, whether he plays or not, and he's fine, what's going to happen? We're going to get $20 million, right? And this is minus, this is plus. How about if his back hurts? What happens? Do we? What? He can, will he? Will, if his back hurt, if his back hurts, will he play in this scenario? Will he gain $2 million by it in a situation where you've told we're going to pay him $6 million whether you play or not? Zip, right? He gets nothing at all for playing. He gets $6 million, that's very nice. But he gets it if he doesn't play too. Alright? If, you know, you could imagine a different contract where the deal is conditional on the doctor's report. But in this one, he plays or he doesn't play. If he doesn't play, then we get nothing. And since in this one, although he could play, and although we're giving him $6 million, we're giving him $6 million if he doesn't play too, so his reward for playing is zero. All right? So therefore, he doesn't play, and we get zero, and of course, he can't play. So if we look at this one, that's going to be minus $6 million here, 50% chance of plus, $20 million, and adding these up, a 50% chance of zero. All right, 2.25. Down this chain, if he's fine, what happens? He plays. Pay $10 million, and we get 20. So on net, we get plus 10. All right. So far. How about what happens down here if he is backwards? A little. He plays, but he doesn't get $10 million unless he plays on this deal. Right? So, it's again plus 10 for us. Pay him $10 million, we get $20 million in ticket receipts. How about down here? We don't pay him anything, we don't get anything. And this is 0.5, 0.25, 0.25. see if I can figure out where on my pretty little picture that exists and how much of it I can get onto the screen. Yeah, not getting all of it onto the screen unless I shrink it down a little bit, which I don't really want to do. Maybe I better just a minute. Let's shrink it down to, call it 80%. I think I can squeeze in 80%, maybe. Almost. Got to find a better way of doing this. Eliminate some of the stuff. Anyway, so you can now see what we've just done. 6 million, 50% chance we get 20 million, 25% chance we get 0, 25% chance we get 0. Take that stuff off. And down here, so what's the value of that outcome? At this point, how much do we get out of it if we follow that path? The top half. 10 million. What? At this point, we get 10 million and the minus 6 is here. At least that's the way the book is doing it. But yeah. So that's plus 10 minus 6, so on net 4. All right. And if we go down this path, this one, we're making a total of 10 million minus 10 plus 20. Half of 10 million is 5 million. This path, we're making 10 million with 25% chance. 25% chance of 10 million is 2.5 million. So on that, this is giving us 7.5 million and costing us nothing here. So 7.5 is bigger than 4. So therefore, all right. And again, one could carry it further and say, let's look at his alternatives. And in fact, if we suppose we were thinking about this plan, what would the obviously better third alternative for that top line be? Given the rest of it, how can we unambiguously make ourselves better off and get the same payoffs? Yep. Now you're raising hands. That's just a couple.
Paying 6 million
with
the same, the money you raised, paying less money.
Well, I would have said that was the lower branch. How about the unconditional branch? How much ought we to pay him unconditionally?
2.5.
Why do you want to throw away $2.5 million? This guy's going to play if we pay him a penny. Right? That's the deal. He loves playing. He loves having all these fans. So, if you went beyond the problem which specifies the alternatives, you would say, if these are really the facts, maybe the bottom line is right. The top line can't be right. The top line, the answer has got to be, if you're going to offer him an unconditional contract, it ought to be a penny or zero, or maybe he'll pay you for the pleasure of playing for you. You know, why should you give a guy $6 million when the only result is that he does the same thing he did? Now, maybe the answer is yes, but it won't make the news story if it's independent, so we got to do it for PR or something. Yes, no? Not making sense? I'm really going beyond what the book's chapter does, but I think it's a useful exercise to sort of think of expanding on that. Now, a different exercise you might do is to say on this one, what ought we be paying? If we really want to maximize our return, what should that number be instead of 10 million? If we want to get this pattern as cheaply as possible, 2 million with maybe a penny, right? Because that's enough to get us to here. Why throw away money here? And it doesn't matter how much you are, because you're not paying him on the bottom line. All right? So again, I think it's a useful way of just sort of structuring the problem so you can see more clearly what, if we were all infinitely clever, we would see when we look at the problem. All right? Questions?
Anything unclear that you want to make clear at this point? Let me...
Oops. Not sure that's particularly useful either. So I guess I... Alright. In case anybody's curious, the reason this machine is called Meep is because the first netbook I have, which ended up my daughter, was called EEP because it was EEPC, and this is the Macintosh version. So I thought of calling it Mackie, but that's the same thing. All right. How about questions in the book? Do people have any difficulty following through the logic of doing the same stuff? Yes, no, maybe. If this book were available on Kindle or on the web, how many people would choose to buy it? You would. I'm just curious about sort of the way the technology is moving, because it costs almost nothing. I mean, the book for my other course is available on the web because it's my book. Yep.
Is the book available on the web?
No.
No, it's not.
This one is not, as far as I know. The book I'm using in my other course is, because I wrote that one. This one I didn't write. You read my Law and Order? Good book. Okay, right. I think I may have mentioned Monday that one of the reasons I web my book is this thought that people who aren't in the course are interested. Yesterday, or maybe this morning, I got an email from a 16-year-old in New Zealand with a question about Law and Order. Isn't that neat? The 16-year-olds are just as smart as 23-year-olds, let me tell you, right? They don't know as much, but they're just as smart. You don't get much smarter past that. Not even sure. Maybe even 12-year-olds are. I don't know quite where the limit goes. But I think we tend to overestimate the superiority of adults. All right. So anyway, no, the book is the book that was assigned for this course, and that's the one that various people have. And I'm sure it costs lots of money because textbooks cost much too much money. And I'm wondering sort of how long the dam is going to hold before people start providing the books in machine-readable form, which is to produce and a whole lot cheaper to buy. And I guess it's an interesting question. Actually, I really ought to ask this question this evening, because the question is, the people in the other class, how many did read the book? They did buy the book. Maybe I shouldn't grab my books, but I'm not going to sell any. On the other hand, I write books mainly as a way of spreading ideas, not mainly as a way of making it in. All right. If you don't have any more questions, I will go on to the problem in the book, which I don't think I've got on the computer at this point. Yes, if I can. Projector off. Nice little buttons here. Don't seem to do anything. How about we take a more direct approach to this problem? Nope, that doesn't do anything either. All right, I just unplugged my computer from the thing. System off, maybe? All right. So this problem was the one in which the question was whether it was worth hiring an expert. So that was, again, a problem basically about the value of information. And you can find it in the book. I don't remember what page it is. I could look. But basically, the problem is that you want to know whether the costs to your clients are better estimated to your client at $200,000 or $400,000. And once you know that, you also know things about additional research you might want to do in order to establish those costs. Thank you. Right. I'm assuming that everybody read the chapter and therefore they would use the problem more or less. All right. So in this one, your expert costs you $20,000. The cost of hiring an expert, and the expert can tell you whether you ought to be asking for high or low damages. And it's 0.5 that you ought to be asking for $400,000, and it's 0.5 that you ought to be asking for $200,000. Those are the numbers as given. And if you ask for $200,000, either way, you can then spend an additional $10,000 gathering evidence to support your claim. All right? So think about the expert's consultant fee is $20,000 and the evidence gathering by whoever does it is $10,000. And you can do it either way. And if you gather evidence when you're making a $400,000 claim, the result is that you have a 0.8 probability of getting 400,000 and a 0.2 probability of getting 350,000. All right, and if you don't spend the extra money on gathering evidence, then the numbers become 0.7 and 0.3. All right, so the first number is if you spend your 10,000, you're buying a higher probability of prevailing. If you don't buy it, probabilities, and the numbers for the low estimate are if you spend the money, it's 0.8, 0.2 again, and this time it's 0.8. No, I'm wrong. If you on the low probability, if you spend the money, you get your 200,000 for sure. 1.0 probability, and if you don't spend the money, you have a 50% chance of that, and a 50% chance of getting only 150,000. This is a great case. You can't lose. No possibility at all. They'll decide that it was a bogus case and that they're the defense. I'm just sketching out stuff that's in the book. So now let's figure out how we draft this. What's the first decision you're making? First decision, anybody? Hire an expert or not hire an expert? Hire? Don't. If you hire an expert, what are the two possible outcomes? The expert recommends high-low. All right. So, high-low. How about if you don't hire the experts? What happens if you don't hire the expert? We don't have a high-low random choice, but what's the point then at which the random element occurs? What? Win high, win low, right? So we now have the court proceeding. All right. And the court proceeding without the expert, there's a 50% chance that you'll get $150,000. And the 50% chance that you will get $350,000. So before we do the rest of it, let's just solve this bit. Well, we've got it there. What's a 50% chance that each of those two things work? What was that? 250, because we say the sum of this is 500, and you've got a 50% chance of getting the sum, you've got a 50% chance of each of the pieces of it. That's a quick way of seeing it. Obviously, we take half of this and half of this, but that takes longer. So, therefore, if we get to this point,
that's worth 250,000.
And since we're not paying for an expert, and we're ignoring this particular problem litigation expenses, that's the result of making this choice to be 250,000 on average. All right? Are you happy with that so far? How about this choice? Well, high and low, what's our next choice that we have to make? It's a little more complicated. I'll be able to pick it up. Spend or don't spend the extra money on the evidence. So, spend, and that's 10,000. And don't spend, and that's zero. And each of these then ends up with what? What's the final random event on those, on that branch? What the outcome is at trial. So if we don't spend the money, then according to the notes here, if we're on the high branch here, Right? That's the high branch. We've hired him. He's told us, boy, do you have a good case. So we're on the high branch. And on the high branch, if we don't spend, we have 0.7 probability of getting 400,000. 0.7 of 400. Thousand and 0.3 of, I think, 350, isn't it? Yeah. And 0.3
chance of 350,000.
So, anybody want to figure out what that comes out to?
Real quick, calculator or mental arithmetic.
3/10 of 350,000. 1/10 would be 35,000. So 3 are 105,000. And 7/10 to 400,000. 1/10 would be 40. So 7 is 4 times 7 is 200 is 28. So 280,000. Is that right?
I think that's right.
And that is 385,000. I haven't made any mistakes.
All right.
So the value of getting to here is 385.
Everybody happy with that so far?
If you do spend the extra money, now your chances of litigation are a little higher. Wait a minute. I made a mistake. No, I didn't. Right. That's where you spend the money. So, I'm getting confused. Sorry, it's up here. Here is where you spend it. And if you spend, then if I remember correctly, it's 0.8 chance of 400 and 0.2 chance of 350. Sorry, I'm not really doing this diagram right because I'm getting crowded and I'm not tall enough to reach this. So 0.2... of 350, 0.8 of 400. All right, makes sense. 0.8 of 400 is 320. 0.2 of 350 is 70, so that's 390. 385 here, 390 here. Should you spend the extra money on evidence? Want to tell me why we shouldn't? We're spending $10,000 to get $5,000 increase in return, right? Remember, we've still got the $10,000 here. It's at this point that it's $390, but to get to this point costs us $10,000. So at this point, following this chain gives us $380, following this gives us $385. So, boom. All right. Fire our investigator before we pay him. Following down this choice, we've got the same thing, except it's lower so I can reach it. Spend, don't spend. And again, spend is costing us minus 10, and this costs us nothing. Again, we get to trial. And the numbers that I have here on the low end, if we don't spend, the odds are 0.5 each, 0.5, and the payoffs at that 0.5 at the low end are 200 and 150. 200 and 150. So we've got a 50% chance of getting each of those. What's it worth to have 50% chance of 200,000 50 chance of 150? 175. Very good. 175. Up on this line, things are getting a little bit crowded. Let me erase my arithmetic. So up on this line, we have a certainty. This one is easy, right? This one is... Once we get here, this is just 100,000. There's no random element at all left there. That's just an end point, because supposedly if we spent the extra money in the low case, we can prove it. Don't believe it, but that's what we say. So we get 100,000 here. We get 175,000 here. Wait a minute.
Sorry.
Just a minute. No, it's 200,000 for sure. Sorry.
200,000 for sure.
So we have 175,000 here. We have 200,000 here. And it costs 10,000 to get there. So which do we do? Spend.
Cut off that.
So we now know that these are 0.5, 0.5. We now know that hiring gets us to a 0.5 chance of 385. Because remember, once we've cut off that branch, the 385 then goes back up to here. All right? That's clear? And down here, cut off this branch. 200 minus 10 is 190. All right? Follow that? So therefore, we have 50% chance of 385, 50% chance of 190. If you add up those two numbers, that gives you 575 over 2. Is that right? I think that's right. 575 over 2, and that's 250 plus 30 is 280 plus 7, 287.5. Right. Comes of growing up before calculators. So, therefore, getting to here is $287,500. And what did hiring cost it? $20,000, I think. Hiring was minus 20. So, therefore, following this chain gives us 267.5. Following this chain gives us 250. All right. Be clear? Any questions? All right. Well, we've got about 20 minutes to go. So why don't we talk a little bit about game theory? We've really done as much as this stuff deserves. So in a lot of the decisions we make, there's only one player in the game. Right? If you're trying to decide, all of these are set up as if there's one player, because we're told what the other guy is going to do. But if you're deciding, let me take a decision that I just made earlier today. I'm giving a talk in Columbus, Ohio next week, taking advantage of Martin Luther King Day, which lets me spend Monday flying out there, Tuesday give the talk at lunch, and get home Tuesday evening. Due to the time shift, it was a little tricky to figure out how I could get there, subject to my classes obligations. But coming back, it turned out there were two flights worth considering. One of them left at about 5:30 through Chicago, and one of them left at about 6:30 through Dallas, and they took about the same length of time. My obligations in Ohio were going to be over by about 4:30. I'd like to catch about a 4:30 flight, but there weren't any 4:30 flights. So therefore, the first obvious decision is to say, well, I need to take the earlier flight, get home earlier, why waste an extra hour cooling my heels in the Columbus airport. What's the reason why I might make the other choice? You might think of what time of year it is. This is next week we're talking about.
It could be the minor
course
knowledge noted.
One of the airports is Chicago and one of the airports is Dallas. It could be. It is just barely possible that snow is more common in Chicago than it is in Dallas, right? I, in fact, decided to take the Chicago flight. I'm willing to take the risk. I did check what the weather predictions were, and they are predicting snow. But my point is that in making that decision, there was nobody playing the other side of the game. I could just take as given the state of nature. What are the odds? Now, we don't always really believe that. Presumably, you're familiar with what's sometimes called Finagle's Law. Finagle's Law is if something can go wrong, it will. And people also talk about the innate perversity of inanimate nature. And there are times when it feels as though the world's against us. And as though whatever we do,
something, you know, if you wear your coat, it's going to be hot. If you don't wear your coat, it's going to be freezing, that kind of thing. But that's not the way it really is. So a lot of our decisions and a lot of the stuff we've been talking about in this chapter, and most of what one talks about in economics, it turns out, is actually done in such a way that you can treat all the rest of the problem as inanimate nature. That in ordinary economics, the parts of economics that are reasonably easy to work through are things like perfect competition, where everybody is such a small part of the market that he knows that his actions don't affect anybody else, so everybody thinks what people are doing is given, or other cases of that sort. The place where it gets hard is when you've got two players, each of whom is calculating against the other, or more than two players. And let me give you the very simplest such game, which you have undoubtedly played hundreds of times in your life and will play hundreds of times again. And it's a game that economists call bilateral monopoly. And bilateral monopoly is a very simple game. You and I am the only person in the world with any apples. I only have one apple. And you are the only person in the world who likes apples. And the apple is worth zero to me, because I don't like apples either. And it's worth a dollar to you. At what price do I sell to you? It's called bilateral monopoly because I'm a monopoly seller. I have the only apple in the world. And you're a monopoly buyer. It's called a monopoly. You're the only consumer of apples. What price is it? How do you figure out what price I'm going to sell it? If you have a really good answer to this question, you will be famous. Because there aren't any as far as I know. You see why it's a hard problem. All right.
If I can persuade you that 90 cents is my low price, you, as a rational individual, say it costs 90 cents, it's a dollar to me, I'll buy it.
What's the flip side of that? What do you want to do? You're the buyer, I'm the seller. What do you want to sell me? That's right. What you want to say is, I'd really be a winner to pay you 90 cents for that apple. It's completely worthless to you. You're going to trash it if I don't buy it. So just to be nice, I'll take it off your hands and I'll even give you a nickel for it. All right? In the range, what's called the bargaining range, from zero to a dollar, any decision benefits both parties. Relative to no decision, relative to the range. All right? I mentioned very briefly earlier von Neumann's solution to the two-player game. And what von Neumann solved is the two-player fixed sum game, meaning a game where anything that helps me hurts you. So if you think about some game where whatever you win, I lose, poker say, that's a fixed sum game. And von Neumann was able to show, in some sense, there's a solution to that game. Von Neumann's solution involves each player picking a strategy. And my strategy has the characteristic that it guarantees me a certain result, say 10 cents. Your strategy has the result that it guarantees that I won't make more than 10 cents, and therefore you won't lose more than 10 cents. So therefore, there is no strategy I could play which would get me more than 10 cents if you play yours. And there is no strategy you could play which would result in losing less than 10 cents if I play mine. And that's the so-called bilateral solution. Bilateral monopoly is not a fixed-sum game. Why is it not a fixed-sum game? What are the outcomes which don't merely involve one of us better off than the other worse off? What's the one outcome which unambiguously does not result in one side's gain and the other side's loss? What? So for a dollar, one guy gains, one gets this guy compared to anything else. Compared to 50-50, one guy gets 50 cents more, one guy 50 cents less. What's the one outcome which doesn't have that characteristic? Which, putting it differently, the sum of the gains, if I sell it to you at any price, the sum of our two gains is a dollar. It's worth zero to me, so what if you pay me 40 cents, I gain 40 cents. It's worth a dollar to you, so if you pay me 40 cents, you gain 60 cents. What's the one outcome of which that's not true? I don't sell it, right? And yet that's a possible outcome because you're trying to insist that you won't buy it unless I give it to you at a low price. I'm trying to insist I won't sell unless you pay a high price. Both of us have the threat of bargaining breakdown. That's why it's not a fixed sum game. because there is one outcome. And if you think about when I say you played this game hundreds of times, and we'll play it hundreds of times, every time you're bargaining over the price of the good, that's the game you're playing. Every time you're bargaining with your kid over when he's going to go to bed, that's the game you're playing. All right. Every time you're negotiating for a salary, that's the game you're playing. Every time you're discussing with your wife what restaurant to go to when you have very different tastes, you're playing a version of that game. All right? Well, we could just stay home. Yeah, that's the loss. That's the bargaining breakdown solution, assuming you both prefer either restaurant to staying home. Maybe you don't. So that game, bilateral monopoly, by itself is an extraordinarily simple game and an extraordinarily hard one to find any clear and unambiguous answer to what happens. But there are some lessons with regard to the game. One lesson is the value of commitment strategies. I mentioned that last time. And if I can somehow tie my hands, if I can take some irreversible action, such that I can't sell it to you for less than 90 cents, once you see me having done that, now you're going to agree to pay 90 cents. All right? If you can take some irreversible action such that you can't pay me more than 10 cents, if I can see you doing that, I give it to you for 10 cents. So one of the things you want to think about in any bilateral monopoly situation is what commitment strategies are available to the two parties. Have any of you ever heard of a doomsday machine? One person has. Have any of you ever seen Dr. Strangelove? The movie about a doomsday machine. Herman Kahn probably isn't alive anymore, but he was a guy who, back during the Cold War, tried to think carefully about the logic of the threats of thermonuclear war. And he wrote a book called On Thermonuclear War, which was an attempt to do that. And he got a lot of flack for doing that on the grounds that you shouldn't really talk about whether this option will kill 100 million people or 200 million people. And so he wrote another book called Thinking About the Unthinkable in order to respond to that. And Herman Kahn came up with what he called a doomsday machine. And a doomsday machine was a solution to the problems of deterrence. And it was very simple. You build a lot of really dirty hydrogen bombs designed to produce as much fallout as possible. And if all of them go off, all life ends on Earth. You don't have to worry about bombers and missiles. You just bury them in the Rocky Mountains. And you have a trigger which will set them off if the Soviets attack us with nuclear weapons. You tell the Soviets that you've got this, and now you're home free. You can scrap all the rest of your defense. At least as far as nuclear things are concerned, you have to worry about conventional defense because the Soviets, like you, don't want to go down. Now, Kahn was not proposing we do this. What Kahn was arguing was we had done it. That this was a stylized version of what both sides had really done, which was to have lots of bombs on lots of bombers and missiles and things commanded by people who would shoot if the enemy attacked. And if you think about it, it sort of reveals both the logic and the illogic of the situation. Because on the one hand, once you know the Soviets have attacked, you don't want to blow up the world. And once you know this, now, it's a little tricky in terms of the historical case, but there were real arguments as to whether the thermonuclear war was really the end of the world, or just a good deal worse than World War II. And you might argue that if you think that all a nuclear attack does is to kill half the population, or a third of the population, maybe you do want to shoot back in order that the survivors, your side wins than the other. But if you take the extreme version that lots of people believed in, then once they attack, you want to throw away all your weapons, but you want to set things up so you can't throw away your weapons in order that they won't attack. Right, that's the basic logic. Let me tell you another story, which I'm going to claim is the same story, many stories, the same story. Long time ago, I was in the econ department at UCLA. And somebody gave a talk arguing against the rational model of human behavior in the context of law. And he tells the following story. There are two guys in a bar, and they get in an argument about football teams, about whose football team is better. And they both been drinking a little bit. And when it's over, one of them is lying dead on the floor, and the other is standing there with a broken beer bottle in his hand and a dazed expression on his face saying, "What have I done?" Now he says, this can't possibly be rational behavior because the guy regrets it as soon as it happens. And I got up on one side of the room, and Earl Thompson, who was one of my colleagues, got up on the other, and I'm probably stylizing this in my memory, but now it should have happened if it didn't, and we both thought, no, no, it's a doomsday machine going off. Because think for a moment about an aggressive personality seen from the standpoint of a rational economist. You're a big tough guy, and you train yourself to have a short temper. You train yourself to be the sort of person who beats up people when they cross. If a guy dates the girl you're trying to date, that's crossing and you're going to kill him. You know, for many other things. Well, you don't, of course, want to beat people up. You might get hurt, you might go to jail, but you don't have to as long as I know you would. So you've now set up a situation, just like a doomsday machine, where other people know that they ought to defer to you in a variety of ways if they don't want to risk getting beaten up. Rational behavior. The problem is that you're not the only guy in the world doing this. All right. If almost nobody does it, it's really a winning strategy. But a few other people do it. And one day, you come into a bar, and you point out to a guy there how much better your football team is than some other football team. And since you're a big, tough, aggressive guy, you expect him to say, well, yeah, of course, it must be right. But he doesn't, oddly enough. He insists his football team is better. And, of course, he's playing the same strategy you are. Both of you have a commitment strategy. Both of you have built in the short fuse you can no longer control. Because you could control it. It wouldn't work as a commitment strategy because people would just expect you to back down. So you can't back down. And when it's over, he's lying dead on, one of you is lying dead on the ground. And the other one is standing there with a broken beer bottle in his hand saying, what have I done? Alright? So that's a new invention. Again, it's just a different version. I should say, Kahn also had an improved version, which he called a doomsday and a hurry machine. And the doomsday and a hurry machine is much harder to build it. But the doomsday and a hurry machine, the trigger doesn't only end the world if the Soviets attack us. It also ends the world if the Soviets invade West Berlin. And we can have a few other things on our list. All right? And as long as they know how it's programmed, and as long as it can really detect these things, it can be the hard end of that to actually do, then we don't need a conventional defense either, because the Soviets know that if they do various things in our list of things they shouldn't do, the world will end. Dr. Strangelove, is this course supposed to end at 4 or 10 up? Do you remember? 5 up. All right, fine, I got a couple minutes. Dr. Strangelove, what's happened is that the Soviets have built a doomsday machine. A crazy American Air Force commander launches a first strike on the Soviet Union. And they haven't told us about the doomsday machine because they're waiting to announce it on the premier's birthday. The world ends. The implication. And I should say, the plot, as far as I can tell, was stolen from a book called Red Alert, which I thought was a much better story. Because in Red Alert, the Air Force officer is not crazy. He's a sympathetic character. He is a guy who was in Eastern Europe when the Soviets came through at the end of World War II. He saw all sorts of horrible things being done. And his professional estimate is that the U.S. can win a first strike now. But we can't do it 5 years from now. The Soviets are gradually catching up. So what he does in that one is to set up from the standpoint that he's commanding the largest strategic air command wing. And he sets it up so from the standpoint of his people, it looks like there's been a nuclear attack. He's controlling the communication system, basically. He sends them in. He then informs the rest of the Air Force, my boys are going in, you can't stop them, you might as well follow them in and do a thorough job, and he then kills himself to make sure that he can't be forced to give whatever the keywords are in order to stop. So it is that he's a sympathetic character in the sense that, yes, he's willing to kill a huge number of people, but he's willing to kill himself, too. In that sense, he's willing to pay the price. Whether that was a better story, but anyway. But Dr. Strangelove, I think, is to some extent a parody of Herman Kahn, although I think he's also a parody of Werner von Braun and a couple of others as well. But anyway, so this is sort of an introduction to some of the reasons game theory is fun and interesting thing to do. And we will continue in a week. You all get a day off. And think of your questions, because I don't stop for long as I should, as long as I should when I'm asking people to ask questions. So think of your questions very in advance.
I'm happy to have people.
Okay. On the on the description, it said that you record your courses. Is that true?
We do.
Oh, and turned it off.
Yes, I recorded and put up on the website Monday's class.
Oh, great. So then I can catch up.
Yeah.
And so did you have a syllabus?
On the web.
I
you need the website. Yeah, I use my own website. It may possibly have been a mistake, but when I originally came around 15 years ago, I reached a low opinion about the computer system here, so I just got my own ISP and did it myself, and I probably should stop doing that, but I do. My website is www.daviddfriedman.com. Remember the D in the middle. That's my middle initial. If I'd applied for it 3 months earlier, 4 months earlier, I could have gotten it without the initial. But there's another David Friedman out there who also wanted a website. So, yeah. The funny thing is, one of the things I discussed in the law and econ class is the virtues of the rule of you have to clean up your own messes, giving people an incentive not to make messes. And it occurred to me that there is a certain logic to the fact that I teach two classes almost in succession, because it means that I have a good incentive to erase my own blackboard. Spending time that's fun. And similarly, it's not clear to me